Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, February 23rd, 2025. We open with the latest essay from Margaret Renkel in the New York Times, who is a contributing opinion writer reporting from Nashville on flora, fauna, politics, and culture in the American South. Her essay is entitled Praise Song for a False Spring. Last month, while the rest of the world was burning up during the hottest January on record, it was unseasonably cold here in Middle Tennessee. I walked around my yard, exulting at the sharpness in the air, at the cold blue of the daytime sky, and the starry brightness at night. After a fall that lingered and lingered, winter was here at last. A real winter. In the natural order of things, winter keeps trees and woody shrubs in dormancy, their fall-set buds still tightly furled. Winter's dry air brings a squinting new clarity to the light. From time to time, snow turns every winter bare branch into a chandelier. But we can't count on snow anymore. Some years it pours out of the sky and settles in drifts that last for days. Some years there's none at all. I rejoice when the natural world is working more or less as it ought, if only in this little pocket of the natural world. It happens so rarely now. Mostly our temperatures run higher than average, sometimes much higher than average. Then a random cold spell, sometimes much colder than average, will have me digging around in the backyard, or the back seat, for the coat I haven't needed in weeks. This kind of boomerang weather is one reason many scientists have stopped referring to global warming and adopted global weirding in its place. The atmospheric scientist Catherine Hayhoe has a video series explaining how it works. After an unseasonably cold January, February began with highs that were 20 degrees warmer than average. A few days later, we were back to normal February temperatures again. This kind of boomerang weather is called false spring, a day or two of warmth bracketed on either side by cold, and it is a normal phenomenon of winter. Overnight, winter turns into spring, and overnight it turns right back into winter again. This year, false spring blew in on a gust of warmth and birdsong, offering an unexpected chance to dawdle in the mild light. I sat on the back steps and closed my eyes, listening. The birds were singing as if it were April, their songs overlapping, coming from every corner of the yard. I opened Merlin, a free app from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology that identifies birds by their songs, and it picked up no fewer than 12 bird species, all singing at once. Robins and crows and flickers were stalking around the yard, gobbling up the insects, stirring in the leaf litter. The resident bluebirds, who had spent all winter sticking close together in large extended families, began to quarrel again, preparing to establish territories. One male took up his post on top of the bluebird box and tried very hard to entice his mate, who was watching from the bare branch of a bare maple tree, to look inside. Historically, false springs were transitory. Now, climate change seems to be increasing their frequency and severity, with sometimes disastrous effects for plant and wildlife and farmers. If a false spring goes on for days and days, the sap will begin to rise in trees and woody shrubs, buds will open, begin to, and sleeping perennials will begin to wake. The return of winter will blast into blackness anything that has already begun to bloom. Some of those plants will try again next year. Some will be gone forever. When a false spring drags on, birds may begin to nest too early, only to have winter come crashing back again. Nestlings need protein, so their diet consists primarily of invertebrates. When a long false spring finally ends and the hard freeze comes, it takes the insects with it, leaving nothing for the birds to feed their babies. Note to property managers and homeowners, mosquito control services do the same thing. When you use insecticides to kill mosquitoes, you're killing all other insects nearby too, and starving or poisoning baby birds. But worse than a false spring is an actual spring that comes far too early. Our wild neighbors evolved to behave according to seasonal cues when astronomical spring and meteorological spring are in sync. Migrating birds and butterflies evolved to arrive in ecosystems filled with food. Bees evolved to wake into a world filled with flowers. Birds evolved to nest in a season filled with insects. I was relieved that this year's false spring was brief. I was relieved, too, when I checked my bluebird box and found only signs that a family had been taking shelter there on cold nights. The male will once again lay claim to it when true spring arrives, just as he always does, and the female will build a nest while he watches over her, just as she always does. For now, for the first time in a long while, the seasons are holding, keeping everyone safe. The natural world is under assault by human beings living thoughtlessly, demanding too little of politicians and businesses, by corporations prizing profits over sustainability, even when climate inaction imperils their own future profits, by, quote, leaders, unquote, who claim that nothing is happening and work to suppress all evidence that it is. In this context, a breath of spring, not too long and not too short, is a welcome idyll, necessary and necessarily fleeting. What's happening in my yard doesn't say anything about what's happening in the rest of the country, of course, much less what's happening in the rest of the world. But I am grateful for it nonetheless. Any sign that nature is working as it ought, however circumscribed and however brief, reminds me to keep faith in the future. Sitting on my back steps in the sunshine on that first warm day in early February, not sure yet whether it was false spring or a real spring arriving dangerously early, I thought of what a wise friend said when I was panicking about the election. No matter what happens, it's not the end of the story. False spring isn't meant to last. Perhaps it isn't meant to do anything. But to me, it has always been a welcome reminder, deep in winter, of the promise of new life. As bad as things are, as bad as they might yet get, this is not the end of the story. We don't know what will happen, but we know this. Even the bitterest winter doesn't last forever. Spring is coming. And this guest essay in the New York Times by Margaret Renkel is entitled Praise Song for a False Spring. It was posted on February 17, 2025. In her essay, Margaret Renkel refers to the app Merlin, which is free from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. It identifies birds by their songs. Part of the mission of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is to help people find the answer to what's that bird? We know sorting through a massive field guide, using search engines and other resources, can make it really challenging. Merlin is designed to be a birding coach for birdwatchers at every level. Merlin asks you the same questions that an expert birder would ask to help solve a mystery bird sighting. Notice that date and location are Merlin's first and most important questions. It takes years of experience in the field to know what species are expected at a given location and date. Merlin shares this knowledge with you based on more than 800 million sightings submitted to eBird from birders around the world. Merlin also asks you to describe the color, size, and behavior of the bird that you saw. Because no two people describe birds exactly the same way, Merlin presents a short list of possible species based on descriptions from Cornell Lab experts, as well as thousands of bird enthusiasts who helped teach Merlin by participating in online activities. They've contributed more than 3 million descriptors to help Merlin match your input with the most likely birds. When you identify a species and click, "This is my bird," Merlin also saves your record to help improve its future performance. Some people experience birds through the viewfinder of their camera, and putting a name to the bird they just photographed can be both rewarding and educational. The photo ID feature in Merlin allows anyone with a camera to snap a photo and get a list of suggestions. Photo ID is yet another method to help you identify the birds you encounter. The lab launched Merlin in 2014 with the goal of adding more species and more features in time. The lab always appreciates your feedback about what's working for you and isn't, and features you would like to see. Our team is made up of 5,000-plus birders spanning the globe who have contributed photos and audio recordings with eBird, as well as everyone who has submitted their sightings to eBird. We are grateful to our talented undergraduate students who have put many years' work into curating the data that Merlin relies on, managing the text in multiple languages, updating maps, and many other tasks. The photographs and audio recordings used in Merlin were sourced from more than 5,000 contributors who uploaded their media to Macaulay Library. Photos and audio cuts included in Merlin attempt to cover the full range of variation of each species and are selected and edited by the collections team at Macaulay Library and their partners. Special thanks also to recordists from Xenocanto, WikiAvis, Avocet, and the Internet Bird Collection, who contributed their recordings. And there are many contributors who identify the text and copy edit, who are media editors who translate Merlin into Chinese, traditional and simplified, Hebrew, Portuguese, Spanish, German, French, Russian, Japanese. And there are sound ID collaborators. They rely heavily on regional experts that know all the bird vocalizations in their region. Over 150 people have shared their expertise, with major contributions, over 10,000 annotated songs and calls from a list of collaborators. Finally, Merlin is made possible by support from the National Science Foundation grants, from Pennington Wild Bird Food, from Swarovski Optic, the Fawcett Catalyst Fund, and friends and members of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Photo ID was developed in collaboration with Dr. Pietro Perona's Computational Vision Lab at Caltech and by another scientist's computer vision group at Cornell Tech, collaborators on the Visipedia project. Merlin Photo ID uses computer vision technology, which was developed as part of Dr. Gran Van Horn's doctoral work at Caltech, to identify birds in photos. They were first publicly released on November 30, 2017. Sound ID was developed in-house at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, led by Dr. Grant Van Horn, with assistance from Dr. Benjamin Hoffman. Sound ID uses recordings archived in the Macaulay Library to learn how to recognize the vocalizations of different bird species. Sound ID is trained on audio recordings that are first converted to visual representations, spectrograms, then analyzed using computer vision tools similar to those that power Photo ID. Dataset preparation began in 2020 with model development starting in early 2021. The lab thanks the many annotators that helped curate hundreds of audio recordings for each species, which were first publicly released on June 23, 2021. And again, this project was made possible by support from many different organizations, including the National Science Foundation. Our next article also comes from the New York Times, posted on February 16th, updated on February 17th, 2025, by Emily Anthes and the photographs by Emily Elonen. On a mission to heal Gila monsters. After years in big pharma, a chemist pivoted to help save the species that made Ozempic possible. By any measure, the diabetes drug Ozempic has been a blockbuster racking up billions of dollars in annual sales. In the United States alone, pharmacies fill millions of prescriptions for Ozempic and related drugs, which have become popular for their weight loss effects, every month. But in the beginning, before the celebrity endorsements and the think pieces and the global supply crunch, there was just a strange venomous lizard with a flair for intermittent fasting. The Gila monster, which is native to the deserts of North America, can survive on just a few meals a year thanks to a digestion-slowing hormone in its venom. The discovery of this hormone paved the way for Ozempic, making the Gila monster an enormously profitable gift to modern medicine. And last summer, one particular Gila monster, a former pet named Pebbles, needed medicine in return. Pebbles, a resident at the Creature Conservancy, a wildlife education organization in Ann Arbor, Michigan, had been infected with a parasite called Cryptosporidium. Hard to kill, the parasite colonizes the digestive tract and is typically a death sentence for reptiles. A veterinarian had recommended that Pebbles be humanely euthanized. But the Creature Conservancy wasn't ready to accept that fate for Pebbles, who had at least another decade of life potentially ahead of her. "If he can fix her," said Steve Marsh, the founder of the Creature Conservancy, one afternoon last July. He nodded toward a sharply dressed man who was cradling Pebbles in his gloved hands. Tim Cernak, a pharmaceutical chemist at the University of Michigan. A few minutes later, a veterinarian inserted a tube into the lizard's throat, collecting liquid from her stomach. Later, Dr. Cernak would study this sample in his lab, hoping to isolate the parasite and find a drug that could vanquish it. Pebbles was not the patient Dr. Cernak had in mind when he began his career. Until 2018, he had worked at the pharmaceutical giant Merck, developing drugs for people with cancer, HIV, diabetes, and other conditions. Along the way, he had helped develop cutting-edge approaches involving robots and artificial intelligence to speed up the invention of new human drugs. A few years ago, however, Dr. Cernak decided that he wanted to use these tools to make medicines for ailing plants and animals, forging a new field he called conservation chemistry. Gila monsters weren't the only species that had inspired human drugs. There were antibiotics derived from fungi, anti-cancer drugs from plants, and painkillers from animal venom. Dr. Cernak thought it was time for pharmaceutical chemists to give back. "To me, it's this full circle thing," he said. "We're attempting to solve the ultimate health inequity." Conservation chemistry. Dr. Cernak, a native Canadian, had grown up catching leopard frogs and crayfish at his grandparents' lakeside cottage in Quebec. When he left his job at Merck, he wanted to use his chemical expertise for a greater environmental good. "Pharma's rad," said Dr. Cernak, who has a youthful face and the upbeat energy to match. "But I wanted to apply my talents to a love of nature." Initially, he thought he might do research on methane, a greenhouse gas contributing to climate change. But after COVID-19 hit, he began to think more about the existential population-level risks posed by disease. A fungal disease called chytridiomycosis, or chytrid, was driving frogs to extinction. Bald eagles and elephant seals were succumbing to bird flu, and sea turtles were washing ashore with a contagious form of cancer. Treatment options left much to be desired. There were human medicines that could help some sick frogs and sea turtles, but they could cause severe side effects and were unsuitable only for certain animal patients. Dr. Cernak had experience developing targeted anti-cancer drugs, which were designed to destroy cancer cells while minimizing damage to healthy ones. Would it really be such a stretch to do the same thing for a tumor-riddled sea turtle? Precision oncology for a sea turtle. That could totally be done, he thought. The same idea could be extended to ecosystems. In some ways, the invasive, sap-sucking insects that were spreading through America's hemlock groves could be considered a cancer of the forest. Perhaps the tools of pharmaceutical chemistry could help him design a precision pesticide that would wipe out the invasive insects while sparing native ones. Dr. Cernak had a knack for seeing opportunities everywhere and a reluctance to do anything halfway. He began traipsing around hemlock groves at the university's arboretum and asking sea turtle hospitals for samples of tumor tissue. He puzzled over how to get anti-malarial drugs to rare birds in Hawaii and wondered, as just kind of a fun thought experiment, whether he could design monoclonal antibodies that selectively ferried poison to different species of invasive fish. And on a trip to the Creature Conservancy in December 2023, he learned about the plight of pebbles. Robo-drug discovery. Drug development is a famously failure-prone pursuit. Dr. Cernak has ratcheted up the degree of difficulty by focusing on pathogens and patients that are poorly understood. People haven't chosen to look inside of the Gila monster too much, he said. But that's exactly what his team was doing one day last July in a chemistry lab on the University of Michigan's Leafy campus. There are many species of Cryptosporidium, which can infect a wide range of mammals, birds, and reptiles. All of them are understudied, Dr. Cernak said, but the reptile pathogens are a particular mystery. And when the scientists put a sample from pebbles under the microscope, they were startled by what they saw, a single-celled parasite wrapped in a thick, jelly-like coating, an unexpected extra layer of cellular protection. It's like this citadel, Dr. Cernak said. Soon, they would begin looking for a drug to breach this line of defense. On another lab bench, however, the hunt for a better cure for chytrid, the amphibian fungal disease, was already underway. A modular robot in a transparent box glided back and forth, preparing to dispense minute doses of antifungal drugs into a grid of shallow wells. The short-term goal was to identify an existing drug that would be more effective and less toxic than one common chytrid treatment. The robots, the largest of which could run more than 1,500 chemical reactions at once, could quickly test a pharmacy's worth of possibilities on lab-grown chytrid cells. Over the months that followed, the team identified a compound, which Dr. Cernak declined to disclose, that proved promising in both the cells and in the African dwarf frogs that were paddling around in a nearby biology lab. The next step is to test it in additional species. The fact that Tim is moving into this from a field of human medicine is really awesome, said Brian Gratwick, who leads the amphibian conservation programs at the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute and is collaborating with Dr. Cernak. Because that's one of the things that has been missing, that kind of focus, that kind of methodology, and the rigor that is being applied to humans. Into the wild. Over the longer term, Dr. Cernak is trying to engineer a new drug specifically for chytrid. He is using several AI-powered tools, including Google's Nobel-winning software AlphaFold, to visualize the three-dimensional structure of a critical fungal protein and design a drug that binds to it. He is using the same basic approach in his search for new drugs for bird flu and sea turtle cancer. A drug that is sufficiently precise, binding only to that chytrid protein, could potentially be dispensed directly into frog ponds. I kind of imagine those pucks that you put in the back of a toilet Dr. Cernak said, a slow-release type thing. It's a vision he shares with some reluctance. I just really don't want to appear to be the mad chemist who's sprinkling chemicals all over, he said, particularly just because I think chemists are so easy to villainize in conservation. And so we're really trying to find the right way to get it to our patient with having the absolute minimal impact on the ecosystem. Indeed, the idea of deliberately releasing drugs into the environment is likely to make some conservationists uneasy. Pharmaceuticals were never designed to just be sort of broadcast out there, said Catherine Arnold, an ecologist at the University of York in Britain. Human pharmaceuticals, which regularly turn up in the world's waterways, are known pollutants. They can imperil aquatic organisms and fuel the emergence of drug-resistant pathogens. Even dosing animals individually wouldn't eliminate risk, said Thomas Broden, an ecologist at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. Medicated animals could excrete drugs into the environment, he said, or unwittingly poison predators. In India, vultures were nearly driven to extinction after scavenging on the carcasses of cows that had been given a common painkiller. Dr. Broden praised Dr. Cernak's optimism. His heart is in the right place, he said. But even in drugs in humans, we've seen how hard it is to design drugs that are very specific. There are likely to be regulatory and economic hurdles, too. Who exactly is going to pay for a precision cancer drug for sea turtles? And while novel drugs can help buy time for critically endangered species, protecting biodiversity will require addressing larger problems, including climate change and habitat loss. A lot of these diseases we're seeing are a consequence of changes in the environment, animals being stressed or their habitats being degraded, said David Duffy, a cancer biologist at the University of Florida's Whitney Laboratory for Marine Bioscience, who is also working on cancer treatments for sea turtles. What chemists and oncologists can do, he added, is mostly treating the consequences. Pills for pebbles. Dr. Cernak is clear-eyed about these challenges. He has been waiting for more than a year for the federal permits he needs to receive sea turtle tissue, and he has not been able to attract funding for the Pebbles project, even after approaching a drug company profiting from Gila monster-inspired drugs. We have kept the work alive on fumes, he said. Without funding, he could not culture Pebbles' parasite in the lab, which he needed to do before he could unleash the robotic drug testers. So his team used AI-based tools to scour the scientific literature on cryptosporidium, looking for potential treatments safe enough to try without extensive laboratory trials. My biggest fear was that I would overdose and poison Pebbles, Dr. Cernak said. He homed in on a drug that can cure cryptosporidium infections in livestock, but has yielded mixed results in reptiles. In December and January, Pebbles gobbled down 7 doses of the drug, which had been secreted inside dead mice and quail. So far, she has shown no ill effects, but because her digestive system moves so slowly, it could be months before the scientists know whether the drug worked. Dr. Cernak is bracing himself for the possibility that it won't. And then what? We'll try again, he said. This article was written by Emily Anthes, a science reporter writing primarily about animal health and science. She also covered the coronavirus pandemic. On a mission to heal Gila monsters. After years in big pharma, a chemist pivoted to help save the species that made Ozempic possible. Appeared in the February 17th, 2025 New York Times. And you are listening to Science Matters on Sun Sounds of Arizona. The following article was previously broadcast on a program last fall. C. elegans, a research worm, may be the current darling of Nobel Prize-winning scientists, but we can't forget about the humble fruit fly. In this feature article from the October 5, 2024 issue of Science News, we learn how fruit flies help African research take flight. The humble insects are boosting biology across the continent. By Darren Incorvaya. When Amos Abolaji returned to Nigeria from a year abroad, he brought home a strange souvenir, two jars full of fruit flies. The biochemist had been conducting postdoctoral research at the Federal University of Santa Maria in Brazil on the health effects of certain pollutants. He had used laboratory rodents while working on his PhD in Nigeria and wasn't previously exposed to the use of fruit flies. But when Abolaji joined toxicologist João Batista Teixeira da Rocha's lab in Brazil, he told me he stopped the use of rodents for research. Rocha had switched to using the fruit fly Drosophila melanogaster. After working with Rocha, Abolaji understood the power of fruit flies. The fly has a high degree of advantages compared with rodents, especially in resource-limited regions, Abolaji says. They're cheap, easy to raise, require little lab space, and can bring fast results. And they're poised to boost biomedical research across Africa. When Abolaji returned to Nigeria in 2014 and became a professor at the University of Ibadan, he took his jars and converted his office into a miniature fly lab. He's now a key figure in a growing movement to establish fruit fly research across Africa, where rodents are still the go-to subject in studies of genetics, developmental biology, toxicology, and other fields of biomedical research. In Africa, fruit fly studies can help address urgent public health needs, connect local scientists with the global research community, and build research capabilities across the world's second-largest continent. We use the fruit fly as a tool to be able to carry out not just research, Abolaji says, but to raise the next generation of scientists. Animal assistance. Studying animals to gain insights into human biology and medicine goes back millennia, at least as far back as the ancient Greeks. By the 12th century, Arab physician Ibn Zur was testing surgeries on animals before performing them on humans. In the mid-19th century, the Norway rat became a mainstay of lab research because the ubiquitous pest was easily acquired and survived well in captivity. The fruit fly didn't enter the lab until 1900, when Harvard entomologist Charles Woodworth began breeding them en masse for reasons that are not entirely clear. He recommended them to researchers studying genetics, a field still in its infancy at the time, and from there the potential of the flies spread through word of mouth. The Drosophila boom took off in earnest around 1910, after Thomas Hunt Morgan set up his famous fly room at Columbia University. Cluttered with flasks full of flies and bunches of bananas dangling from the ceiling, the fly room hardly compares to the sleek and sterile labs of today. But in that room, Morgan made the groundbreaking discovery that genes are passed down to the next generation on chromosomes. The fruit fly's short life cycle allowed the field of genetics to take flight. Although rats reproduce fast for mammals, pregnancy is typically 21 days, and females reach sexual maturity 2 to 3 months after birth. They have nothing on fruit flies. They can produce a whole new generation in just 10 days. This, plus their small genomes, makes the fruit fly a powerful tool for studying how genes and traits are passed down from one generation to the next. Drosophila are also used to study how embryos develop into adults and to test the biological effects of chemicals. Because rodents are even more closely related to humans, they remain popular model organisms for studying mammal-specific traits and in clinical drug testing. Over the last century, 9 scientists have won Nobel Prizes based on work done with fruit flies. Abolaji's fruit fly lab is in Ibadan, the third most populous city in Nigeria and capital of the southwestern state of Oyo. When I reached him over Zoom, he presented a slideshow of his history with Drosophila. "I thought it would be good if I just share it like a story," he told me. Several years after bringing fruit flies back from Brazil in 2014, Abolaji was approached by Dros Africa, an organization founded in 2013 to expand the use of Drosophila by African biologists. A trio of Spanish researchers started Dros Africa after a workshop in Uganda on using insects in neuroscience research. Physiologist Sadiq Yusuf, who was then the deputy vice chancellor of Kampala International University and later went on to fund a charity supporting research development in Africa, called TREND, or Trend, had organized the workshop. The Spanish group had recognized that African researchers were primed to use fruit flies to accelerate the continent's research, which is what had happened in Spain a few decades earlier. From Morgan's fly room, D. melanogaster spread quickly to other research labs in North America and Europe, but not every country caught fly fever. In Spain, virtually no one worked with a fly until Antonio Garcia Bellido returned to his native country after finishing a research fellowship at Caltech in the U.S. in the 1970s. Once home, the developmental biologist established a Drosophila lab. He made many significant contributions, including discovering that embryonic cells cluster together based on what anatomical structure they develop into, with their fate controlled by certain genes. Garcia Bellido, it's been said, put Spain on the scientific map. Then he trained three people, and then these three people trained other people, says Maria Lola Martin Bermudo, a geneticist at Pablo de Olavide University in Seville, Spain, and a Dros Africa co-founder. Now there are lots of Drosophila labs in Spain. To jumpstart a similar spread of knowledge in Africa, Abolaji and Dros Africa organized a workshop at the University of Ibadan in 2017, which brought in experienced fruit fly researchers from as far as Spain and the United Kingdom to teach attendees Drosophila biology and how the flies can be used to study neurodegeneration, cancer, and toxicology, as well as help with drug discovery. "That workshop was one of the major turning points in my research," Abolaji says. The workshop hosted participants from elsewhere in Africa, including Uganda, Rwanda, and Ghana. One participant, a young woman from northern Nigeria, named Rashidatu Abdulaziz, traveled 18 hours over 2 days to attend. Meeting urgent needs. Long before arriving at that workshop, Abdulaziz had already become hooked on fruit flies, but she didn't have a jar of flies from another lab to start her work. She had to catch them herself. She'd read that the flies could be trapped outdoors, but nothing she tried had worked. While earning a master's degree in population genetics, Abdulaziz stayed with her auntie while trying to catch flies in the city of Kaduna in northwestern Nigeria. "Perhaps they don't want to stay far from humans," her auntie suggested. Thinking the flies might prefer human trash to other lures, Abdulaziz left out a bowl of rotten fruit overnight. "I had a dream that I caught lots of Drosophila," Abdulaziz recalls with a laugh. And in the morning, her dream had come true. In 2016, after solving the fly-catching problem, she published an analysis of the genetic variation of Nigeria's D. melanogaster populations. Like Abolaji, Abdulaziz had to learn a lot about Drosophila on her own, but it was worth it. "I began to fall in love with fruit flies because I was just so amazed by the fact that we had so much in common," she says, referring to the 60% of our DNA that we share with fruit flies. And importantly, 75% of the genes that cause disease in humans are also found in the flies. Abdulaziz is now a lecturer, akin to a professor, at her alma mater, Ahmadu Bello University in Zaria. Toward the end of our video call, she took me into the hallway as she headed to a meeting and pointed out the poster on her lab's door, a black and white image of a fruit fly peering through a microscope, with the words "Small Lab, Big Science" blazoned across the top. The big science benefits of Drosophila as a model organism stem from not only its similarities to us, but also its key differences, like being easy to care for. Starting a Drosophila lab can require as little as a jar of flies and a handful of microscopes, while a colony of lab rats can take up an entire room's worth of cages. The ease of using fruit flies is a huge boon for a continent with many local public health concerns, but little local research funding. I desire to carry out research that will have beneficial effects on humans, Abalaji says. Some pollutants in the environment can predispose people to cancer, diabetes, Parkinson's disease, and a whole host of other afflictions, he says, and he uses fruit flies to understand why. One pollutant that Abalaji has studied is 4-vinyl cyclohexene, a byproduct of the manufacturing of pesticides, plastics, and tires. Plastic manufacturing has been growing in Nigeria from 120,000 tons in 2007 to an estimate of more than 500,000 tons in 2020, meaning more and more workers are potentially being exposed to 4-vinyl cyclohexene, or VCH. In monkeys and rats, VCH is known to destroy follicles in ovaries, so there's concern that exposure could cause early menopause in humans. A woman that is working in an environment where such compounds are manufactured or produced or used as byproducts, who is supposed to reach menopause at 56, may reach menopause at age 30 or 35, Abalaji says. But how VCH harms ovarian follicles was elusive. Abalaji got a hint by exposing Drosophila to VCH and analyzing the resulting changes in the fly's gene activity and physiology. The chemical causes the production of toxic types of oxygen-containing molecules, known as free radicals, which damage cells. In Tunisia, Hayat Salami hopes to leverage the power of fruit flies to create a drug screening factory, speeding up the process of identifying new medical treatments. Salami, a medical doctor and researcher, says her journey with Drosophila began with a pair of workshops in 2018 and 2019, hosted by her institution, the University of Sfax, and organized by Dros Africa, and a professional network of scientists called Young Tunisian Researchers in Biology. Impressed by the workshops, university administrators approved creating a Drosophila research unit. Our research unit is the first in Tunisia to use Drosophila as a low-cost model for research, Salami says. She hopes to begin fly research in earnest this year, and once the lab is fully up and running, researchers will be able to quickly screen prospective drugs by testing them on fruit flies. If a drug seems promising, the next step will be tests on rodents. Using Drosophila as a first pass for drugs will save valuable time and money that would otherwise be spent raising and caring for expensive rats and mice. One of Salami's interests is using the flies to test potential antifungal drugs. This is a good opportunity to enhance our university and to have practical research, she says, and lead to better health care for our people. In a 2022 study, 63% of the fungus Candida albicans, collected from a pregnant Tunisian woman's vaginas, was resistant to the common antifungal drug fluconazole. C. albicans is often harmless, but it can cause yeast infections that can lead to rare pregnancy complications. So finding new antifungal drugs is a pressing concern. Building research capacity. The University of Sfax is following in the footsteps of the University of Ibadan, where the small fly lab Abulaji founded in 2014 has blossomed into the separate Drosophila Research and Training Center. It serves as a regional hub for scientists interested in working with fruit flies. Salami hopes that Sfax becomes a hub for North Africa. By investing in fruit fly research, African institutions also now have the chance to join the Iconic Insects Global Fan Club. Biologist Ross Kagan of the University of Glasgow in Scotland was one of the Drosophila researchers recruited by Dros Africa to run workshops. He now collaborates with both Abulaji and Salami on medical research that not only has health implications for Africans, but for people globally. My lab develops some technology we call fly avatar, Kagan says. Using gene editing, specific genetic mutations of individual cancer patients are introduced into fruit flies. The goal is to capture the complexity of a patient's cancer in a group of Drosophila flies to study how those mutated genes affect tumor progression and how the cancer responds to drugs. One of the questions on the table is, what's the difference between a European tumor and an African tumor? Abulaji's team is generating fly avatars that mimic the genetics of Nigerian patients with colorectal cancer. Abulaji is somebody that the more you get to know him, the more impressive he becomes, Kagan says. That collaboration is going beautifully. It is truly growing out of Nigeria. The biggest money for research still lies in Western institutions, and writing grants to get the funding for ambitious projects is difficult, even for scientists in North America and Europe. Western collaborators can help African researchers navigate this path. Salami recently submitted a proposal to Horizon Europe, a 7-year funding initiative of the European Union, in collaboration with Kagan, to support Sfax's research into personalized medicine with fly avatars. Salami and Abulaji have also teamed up to submit a proposal to another EU funding initiative, Erasmus. One thing that makes these international collaborations stand out is that African scientists are guiding the research questions, says Marta Vicente Crespo, co-founder of Dros Africa, and a program manager at the Nairobi-based Consortium for Advanced Research Training in Africa. Often in such collaborations, African researchers get what's been dubbed stuck in the middle. They may collect data, but not analyze or interpret it, while Western scientists lead the project and claim the more prestigious first and last authorship spots on papers. There has been a lot of tokenization, Vicente Crespo says. Things are changing, but very slowly. The legacy of colonization has left many areas of Africa with little capital, which means students looking to do research often have to fund the projects themselves. We don't have funding, Abdulazir says. When you come for any of your degrees, you basically sponsor yourself. Because rodents are expensive, students often can't afford to use many, resulting in studies with low sample sizes and thus conclusions that aren't reliable enough to publish. They get their degree, but the science doesn't go anywhere, Vicente Crespo adds. By using Drosophila, money that might have gone to feeding a few rodents for several weeks can instead turn into thousands of flies. Abdulaziz estimates that one mouse costs about 1,000 naira, the Nigerian currency. Buying 80 of them would cost more than many Nigerians make in a month. A fruit fly homecoming. There is a poetic side to D. melanogaster's rise in African research. Like humans, the fruit fly evolved in Africa before spreading around the world. Though they came to dominate the globe through an association with humans, living off our food waste, they once lived more pastoral lives. Researchers in 2018 found a population of D. melanogaster living in a forest in Zimbabwe, unaffiliated with humans. These flies fed and laid their eggs on the fruit of marula plants. The indigenous San people of southern Africa historically collected marula fruit and stored them in caves where the fruit fermented. Researchers speculate that this shared use of marula ultimately sparked the human-fly connection that persists to this day. Abdulaziz is most passionate about the ecology and evolution of fruit flies. For now, though, as the leader of a new research group, she's focusing on more urgent health problems, like lead poisoning, and on inspiring the next generation of Nigerian biologists. We still have people who are yet to accept the fact that we could use these flies for wonderful things, she says. To combat this problem, she founded Drosophore Nigeria, an organization that works to bring Drosophila-based biology lessons into Nigerian secondary schools and trains teachers to use fruit flies in the classroom. Abolashi also stresses the importance of education and training. The ultimate goal is to raise and develop the next generation of scientists in Africa, he says. While international grants and collaborations are important, the ongoing success of Africa's Drosophila-fueled research boom wouldn't be possible without the passion, talent, and resourcefulness of the African scientists leading the way. During our video call, Abolashi showed me the temperature-controlled incubator he uses to raise flies. A new one can cost upward of $10,000, but Abolashi fashioned his out of an old drink chiller, the kind you'd pull a bottle of soda from at the grocery store, for less than $500. Europe will not develop Africa for us. America will not develop Africa for us, Abolashi says. We are the ones to actually build Africa. And a history of Nobel Prize-winning flies goes like this. As of 2023, 9 scientists have earned a Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine for research done with fruit flies. 1933, Thomas Hunt Morgan, a pioneer of fruit fly research, discovered the role that chromosomes play in heredity. He was recommended for the indigenous choice of object for his experiments, which made it possible for Morgan to overtake other prominent genetical scientists who had begun earlier but employed plants or less suitable animals as experimental objects. 1946. Hermann Joseph Müller, in heredity experiments, ascertained that radiation in the form of X-rays can produce mutations in genes. In 1995, 3 scientists, Edward B. Lewis, Christiane Nuschlein-Volhardt, and Eric F. Vishaus, discovered genes that control early embryonic development. The fruit fly's fast maturation made it the perfect study subject. It takes a little more than a week for a fertilized egg to develop into a fully formed fly. In 2011, Jules A. Hoffman shared the prize with 2 other scientists for work on the immune system. By studying the fruit fly, he discovered a gene that helps the body recognize invading microbes and activates innate immunity, the first line of defense against pathogens. And in 2017, 3 scientists, Jeffrey C. Hall, Michael Rosbach, and Michael W. Young, discovered the genetic and molecular gears that control the body's inner clock, or circadian rhythm. And fruit flies aren't the only important research subjects. Lab animal all-stars include the roundworm, the zebrafish, the mouse, and the rhesus macaque. The roundworm C. elegans, which was part of the recent Nobel Prize-winning research in physiology and medicine, is 1 millimeter long. C. elegans is popular in studies of genetics and development. In addition to having a short life cycle and being cheap to maintain, the worm can be frozen and revived, unlike other lab animals, and its transparent body makes for easy observation of cells. But C. elegans' simple body, lacking blood, most internal organs, and other features of more complex beings, limits its use as a model of human physiology and disease. Its similarity to humans, 65% of disease genes shared. Its age at sexual maturity is 3 days. And its birth rate, more than 140 eggs per day. And then there's the zebrafish, or Danio rerio. About as big as a safety pin, the zebrafish is a vertebrate and therefore more like humans than C. elegans or the fruit fly. Because it's easy to keep in the lab and transparent as an embryo, the zebrafish offers advantages over the mouse in studies of genetics and development. But since the fish lacks certain tissues and body parts, such as lungs, it isn't as versatile in physiology and disease research. Its similarity to humans, 80% of disease genes are shared. Its age at sexual maturity is 2 to 4 months, and its birth rate is 200 to 300 eggs per week. And what about the mouse, or Mus musculus? As far as mammals go, the mouse survives well in captivity, and it's similar enough to humans to be a viable choice for studies of disease and even behavior. Still, many health findings in mice don't end up translating to people. Its similarity to humans, more than 90% of disease genes shared. Its age at sexual maturity, 1.5 to 2 months. And its birth rate, 6 to 12 offspring per litter, up to 15 litters per year. And then the rhesus macaque. As a fellow primate, the rhesus macaque is extremely similar to humans as far as basic biology goes, making the monkey valuable in research into infectious diseases such as HIV/AIDS and chronic illnesses, reproduction, aging, drug development, and more. But a long lifespan, slow reproductive cycle, and complex social structure make the monkey difficult and expensive to keep in captivity. And the close kinship to humans has led to ethical questions about using rhesus macaques and other primates in lab experiments. Its similarity to humans, 97.5% of all genes shared. Its age at sexual maturity is 3 to 4 years, and its birth rate is 1 offspring per year. And the author of this article, Darren Encorvalla, is a journalist based in the Western U.S., covering science, health, and the environment. This article, Fruit Flies Help African Research Take Flight, The Humble Insects Are Boosting Biology Across the Continent, appears in the October 5th, 2024 issue of Science News. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.